paper, it looks like a country set up to fail, born out of civil war with poverty, poor infrastructure, mass illiteracy and ongoing conflict. On July the 9th, later this week, the Republic of South Sudan will formally become the world's 195th independent state. But it will do so with the blessing of major Western powers like the US and the EU, most African countries, and it will have access to 80% of Sudan's oil production areas. Yet it will take more than that to enable President Salva Kiir to create a viable nation-state of 8 million people. So what are the prospects for South Sudan, and what kind of alliances will it have to forge if it's to really make a go of it? That's what we're asking this week on Africa Today.
As Sudan break into two, questions are being raised about whether the South can survive without the North. South Sudan's independence on 9th July follows the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Treaty that ended two decades of civil war and led to the overwhelming support for secession. But there has been an escalation in the crisis as Khartoum seeks concessions on pasture and oil in the disputed Abyei region. It and other oil-producing areas are the lifeblood of both economies. Critics have slammed Western powers for the missing details in the treaty they championed, which have brought both the North and South back to the brink of war. The North is more established economically and has the infrastructure the South needs to turn its oil into money. With a new republic relying on the North for its economic growth and Khartoum unwilling to give up its right to Abyei, Africa Today asked whether Africa's newest nation can survive without its neighbor.
Hello, I'm Henry Bonsu, and this is Africa Today. It promises to be a great occasion, a new nation born from the ashes of decades-long conflict, with the blessing of most of the international community. But after the pomp and ceremony of its formal declaration of independence, the Republic of South Sudan has a daunting in-train. There's mass poverty, internal conflicts, huge internal refugee flows, disputed border areas, and widespread corruption. And that's just for starters. But it does have some things going for it, such as huge oil reserves, a determined finance ministry, and of course, that overwhelming electoral mandate. And yet, the odds look stacked against South Sudan. So what will it have to do? With me are Mark Wadsworth, the editor of TheLatest.com, a citizen journalism news portal, Vincent Mugombe, director of African Inform International, and on the phone from Khartoum, Sudan, Ishmael Kushkush, a freelance journalist. And because you're there, Ishmael, let's go to you first. What's the mood in the capital of what will now be referred to as the North of Sudan, North Sudan?
Right. Well, first, thanks for having me. Since the referendum, I think most northern Sudanese have psychologically prepared themselves for this day. Northern Sudanese, Khartoum, were and still are divided on how they view the separation, independence of South Sudan. For many northern Sudanese, the idea and concept of Sudan's unity was a sacred one. With the separation of South Sudan, that idea has crumbled. But many also, on the other hand, think that this is an opportunity for peace, and if the separation of South Sudan will hopefully achieve peace, then they see that this is an opportunity. I'm looking forward to friendly relations with the South.
Mm-hmm. And given what brought us to this point, those 22 years of civil war, the huge numbers of people who were killed, internally displaced, having to leave the country, many of them as well, I presume they wish their brothers and sisters in the new South well.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody wants to go back to war here. That's what you hear from Northern Sudanese. The 22 years of a civil war, and before that, even before independence from 1955 to 1973, that was the first civil war in South Sudan. And then this was later followed by the war in Darfur and the fighting that we see now in South Kordofan. And I think most northern Sudanese simply want a war to end, and that they hope that South Sudan, the relationship with South Sudan, will be a peaceful one.
Ishmael Kushkush, thank you very much for the moment. Dr. Vincent Mugombe, how excited are you about this prospect, or are you filled with foreboding because there are so many things which are still not being resolved between the North and the South, disputed border areas, what's going to happen to oil receipts, the refining capacity seems to be mainly in the North rather than the South. Both presidents, of course, in Ethiopia this week to try and thrash these out.
No, just like many other Africans, I would be very excited that South Sudan will become a country.
Mm.
They have suffered a long, long time, almost in servitude, one might say. You know, they never really enjoyed their relationship with the North. You know, there was a big civil war, and after the civil war, still, even if there was sort of like partners, they were not real partners. That's why they have chosen to go it alone.
Mm.
Now, the only problem, I think, I wouldn't be personally very optimistic like Ismail is sounding there,
yeah,
because the odds really are very much stuck against the South right now. And they're being caused by the North. You know, it seems we don't have that honesty which General Bashir tried to show before the referendum.
In which way is it caused by the North? Because the North say they do this with our regrets, but fundamentally with our blessing. That's what the president, Omar al-Bashir,
seems to be
saying.
Well, I wish it was just without blessing, because just before the referendum, General Bashir came out and everybody got shocked with mm-hmm. his wonderful overtures to the South, saying that I'll bless this thing, I'll support them, and so on. And then within a few weeks, he started, you know, deploying troops in Abia, Kordofan, where, of course, that's sort of in the north, but still, that was like a staging post, and that's where things are being planned, you know, to cause trouble for the South. So the problem is, here is a new, independent, you know, little child being born, and you're born to actually bear the burden of, again, trying to fight for your survival. I think the North, I don't know whether it is international pressure that will work, or just some good sense, you know, is really a problem to the South. And that problem is because the North itself, within the ruling party in the North, they are very divided.
Yes.
There are some liberal people who want the South to exist and they feel they should go, you know, for example, Vice President Taha and so on. But there are some very fanatical, I don't want to call them Islamists, but they are fanatical fundamentalists who just feel that General Bashir has made a very bad mistake to allow the South to go. And they seem to have given General Bashir that, you know, suggestion that, look, are you with us?
Yeah.
Do you want to survive and go on? Or do you want the South to go? That is why immediately we saw that radical turnaround after the referendum, when General Bashir suddenly became very hardline.
That's right, and we saw all that aggression, and we saw conflicts between the northern and southern troops in some of these disputed border areas, and of course in South Kordofan. But some people, thanks Vincent, say that the problems of the Republic of South Sudan are not necessarily being caused by the North, they're actually being caused by the government of President Kiir itself. They themselves are not really accountable, there's corruption there, there are conflicts taking place within that area itself.
Well, you know, as a diasporan African, I feel bittersweet emotions.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, yes, a new nation emerging, as Vincent said, a happy time. It should be a time for celebration.
And these are people who want to be independent and free, because before they were being crushed, it seems.
But at the same time, a balkanization of Africa.
Yeah.
You know, a 53rd state now.
Well, some say 54th, it depends on how you count.
Depending on how you count.
Yeah.
When that's not the vision of the late Kerrang, you know, that charismatic leader. He wanted to see unity, not more division. But the South has an opportunity to succeed, and succeed very well because of that huge oil wealth. More than 80% of the whole of Sudan's oil reserves. It depends how that's handled, though, doesn't it? Are the Chinese going to move in? Are the West going to move in? Is there going to be this struggle between economic external influences that are going to attempt to control the new leadership? Yeah. And that's a grave concern to me.
Well, let's take a look at one or two of those things in the intro. I mean, what to do about the border areas, what to do about the oil, because, of course, oil wealth in Africa hasn't necessarily been a blessing to many countries. It's been a curse. Is that what's really worrying you initially? Or are you more concerned about the border areas? There's also a very large number of refugees from the north who are coming back down to the south, something like 300,000 since October last year, and the south is struggling to absorb them. Where should we start in terms of the in-tray? Because it's a massive in-tray, isn't
well,
it?
Well, you know, I've been in Nigeria, and they discovered oil in the 60s.
Yeah.
Some people see it as black gold, others as black death.
Yes.
You know, it's been almost a curse on that country with the trickle-down effect of that wealth not reaching regions like the vastly oil-producing Delta area that's still impoverished, polluted. I hope that doesn't happen in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope that the best council is gathered together for wisdom to guide this new nation, and that corruption can be dealt with, and that they can learn the lessons from other parts of Africa that have been enriched by oil.
Let's deal with that oil question. Let's go back to Khartoum in the north of Sudan, Ismail Kushkush. What are people saying there about the oil wealth? Because, of course, they're aware of where the reserves are, whereabouts in the country they are. Are they very, very concerned that 80% of it is in what will now be the south of Sudan?
Right. I mean, oil remains one of the challenges, both for North and South Sudan. The majority of the oil wells exist in South Sudan, but the infrastructure, the pipelines, are mostly in North Sudan. Most of the oil goes through pipelines through North Sudan to Port Sudan on the Red Sea. So the question is how to distribute revenues between South Sudan and North Sudan. Now, many Northern Sudanese, of course, are concerned that the revenues that were gained from the oil wells will be reduced. But nevertheless, there has been talk about new oil fields being found in the south. Now, in the north. In the south, the question is, what kind of relationship will exist with the north, with most of these pipelines and refineries existing in the north? Could they build a new pipeline that would go, say, to Kenya, to the port of Mombasa? How much would that cost? I think these are all questions that are being asked in the south and in the north. And until a final agreement is reached between the government of North Sudan and South Sudan, which to this date has not been reached, I think there will be concern. South Sudan depends on 98% of its revenues from the oil. In the north, oil revenues constituted about 70%, which will go down to 20% now.
And Ismail, do you see evidence of that oil wealth in the country? I mean, Mark was saying a moment or two ago that in Nigeria, a lot of people don't see it, even though they know it's generating billions and billions of naira or dollars. What about in Sudan? Are people saying, well, we're fighting over this split, but actually, we haven't really seen evidence of what this oil wealth has been able to do, not just in Khartoum, but around the country?
Right. I think to a degree you do see the impact of oil and I would also add foreign direct investment in North Sudan. Not to the degree where that satisfies most people, but I think Khartoum and Sudan today is not as it was 20 years ago. Khartoum is a different city. We do see some projects here and there, like the Big Meroe Dam in North Sudan. We see more bridges along the Nile. But, of course, instability in the country, and especially in places like Darfur and South Kordofan, I think have prevented the country from benefiting to the extent that it should from oil revenues.
Mm-hmm. Vincent, what about the oil revenue situation? I mean, what do you think would be the most viable accord between the north and the south? Because at the moment, I think there's a 50-50 split, but that will possibly change after the 9th of July.
Well, I would not even call it 50-50 at the moment. At the moment, there is almost no... there may be things on paper, but in terms of the government, you know, there's almost no understanding between them as to what to do. That's why they're starting to fight over this.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's very interesting you asked the issue about, you know, governance in the north and what happens. I think that what will happen in the south and the stability of the south and the use of that oil will very much depend on what happens with the government in the north. And it's no surprise or secret right now that even if we are not seeing people on the streets like Egypt, like Tunisia, but there is an undercurrent of fomenting rebellion. And I know very well that many political people, even the same fundamentalists and others, but people from Darfur, I've been talking to people from Darfur, I've been talking to politicians and some journalists from the north, from the liberal side, and they seem to indicate that very, 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 very soon, in the next few months, we may see that type of mass uprising
happening in the north of
Sudan. In fact, many people are surprised how it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, General Bashir is in a very weak position, you know, all these things he has done in Darfur. But the governance that he has, sat on in the north, people feel they haven't gained anything at all. You know, he has strengthened the army, and even within the army, you have the main army, which is, the Sudan army, which is almost rejected.
Yeah.
He has set up now very new sort of sections of the army that are specifically meant to...
So look perhaps, after him.
Look after him, but also perhaps prepare for this south-north war that may come up, and also this uprising. There's even a special unit that has been set up specifically to crush any mass uprising. Mm-hmm. Now, I feel that if anything starts there and he uses that type of violence against the people, it will just, as we have seen everywhere, it will just speed up the process.
I'm just wondering, what are the implications of this, and what kind of preparations should President Kiir be making? Because, of course, he will look at his former enemy and say, well, I don't want to go that way. I've got the blessing of the international community, the blessing of the Western powers, the blessing of the NGOs. They look at us and they don't want us to fail. Therefore, I need to proceed very, very carefully. What do you think he should be doing?
Well, it's those alliances, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that you're right. You know, there is a great deal of goodwill out there from the permanent members of the Security Council, the Big Five.
Yes.
The rest of the international community, they've all declared that from Saturday onwards that this new state will be recognised. Mm-hmm. And he has to sort of deal that sort of card in this poker game very astutely, cleverly, and make sure that that pressure is on Bashir in Khartoum, not to be tricky and to give him problems. Yeah. I mean, there is this dispute, isn't there, about Abiye?
Yes, that's right.
Bashir said that if the South continue to make claim on that area, he won't recognise them.
But I think there's an issue about the leadership in the South as well. Mm-hmm. General Kiir.
Yeah, Kiir.
Salva is not necessarily this Democrat of a person. Mm-hmm. I think that many people...
What does his record tell you about him?
He was just a fighter. He led a brilliant war in that civil war. He really was a great at the center of the fighting. And on that strength, he then took power in the South. Mm-hmm. There's no real true record of him being somebody who is a Democrat and so on. And I think that within southern Sudan itself, you know that there are ethnic issues.
Yes.
People belong to different groupings. Who would want, you talk about, for example, his deputy, who also has wanted many times to be the president of southern Sudan. Now, there are so many, there would be natural instincts of people within southern Sudan to try and assume power. So either he provides proper democratic sort of dynamics within southern Sudan where then people have to express themselves through voting. But if he uses some of the methods we've seen in the past, which have been used almost violently, just repressing so-called rebel groups within the South as well, we may then see a typical African situation, post-independent African situation, where you get independence, but the problems again start there from the post-independent leaders.
Yes.
So I think that I'm hoping that he has learned a lesson. He has looked around Africa. He must be seeing all these uprisings coming up, and that the best he can do for his country, apart from, trying to be very diplomatic and try to resolve the issues with the North, the best he can do with these countries to provide proper governance dynamics, in terms of democracy.
And real separation of powers.
Violation of human rights. At the moment, that is a real worry, I think.
Okay. Let me go back to you, Ismail Kushkush, for the final time. And when people in the north of Sudan look at the new situation in the south, are they hoping that President Bashir, weakened or not, will use that as a trigger to maybe govern differently from Khartoum? Because we're not really seeing evidence of that, are we? Despite what Vincent said about his position being weakened, we're seeing some of the Nuba people being attacked by Antonovs and all kinds of planes and missiles, MiGs as well. Are people very concerned about that? Were they hoping for something different from their president?
Well, around the referendum back in January, there were attempts a lot, being influenced by what was happening in the region, especially in Tunisia and Egypt, for some sort of popular uprising. I think most of us really did not expect for that to be successful. for a number of reasons. I think mainly it was that most people were more concerned with the referendum and the separation occurring as peaceful as possible. Mm-hmm. The state was well prepared to deal with any type of disturbance, and the very few attempts for an uprising were put down very quickly. But I think also in North Sudan, I mean, the fact is that Sudan was indeed the first country in the Arab world where we saw popular uprisings back in 1964 and later in 1985. And people are concerned that any uprising will bring back the same old politicians. Many people are critical of the current government, but when they compare it to older politicians and older administrations, I think most are willing to accept the current government than old politicians.
So better the devil you know, All right, Ismail.
I think,
finish your point.
That was very obvious during the elections last year.
All right, Ismail, thank you very much. Let's round up in the studio. Mark, I mean, what do you think we should expect to see? What signs should we look for to see that this new government is on track? What are the early signs, do you think?
Well, it's got to be better than civil war. It's gone on for two decades. I had a correspondent out there from my website, thelatest.com, reporting, you know, from Sudan, from Darfur, and the human misery is beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
You know, 2.5 million people dead, 4 million refugees, and that
with that
continues.
Kind of conflict, how can you develop?
So, you know, that's the first challenge to the leadership, isn't it?
Yeah.
To settle this nation, bind the wounds, and to begin that sort of outreach to the international community so that the correct alliances are built to stabilise and do all the things that Vincent said about good governance, to make sure there are those separations of the executive and the legislature and the military.
Final thought with you, Vincent.
You know, looking what is going to happen, one expects that the independence is going to go through.
Mm-hmm.
We are very much aware that the United States and countries like Uganda are actually militarily preparing under the guise of fighting people like Kony and so on.
Yeah.
But they are preparing for any eventuality. So we may see increasing clashes between the North and the South that may be contained just because of international pressure and that type of, you know, possible intervention of outside forces. In the North, I think we may see some sort of uprising. We don't know how it will end, but I suspect if you have good governance in the North, then it will really help with the South as well.
Vincent, thank you very much. And that's it for today. Thanks to all of you who've sent comments into us. Email africa@presstv.co.uk or text us to this number, +44 7800 00 8086. Messages will be charged at your local operator rates. Many thanks once more to our guests. They were Mark Wadsworth, editor of thelatest.com, Dr. Vincent Magombe, director of Africa Inform International, and on the phone from Khartoum, Sudan, Ishmael Kushkush, freelance journalist. Voice is back next week for another edition of Africa Today. Till then, it's goodbye from me, and on behalf of the whole team, thanks again for watching.